Why is Obama heading to Saudi Arabia? Why is Israel talking up the Golan Heights? And who won big at the Pulitzers? I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House. On the programme today, as US President Barack Obama heads to Riyadh, my guests James Rogers and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing what's really on the table between the US and Saudi Arabia. We'll also be analysing the day's other big stories from Israel to Beijing. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, author and broadcaster for politico.eu, and James Rogers, senior lecturer in journalism at City University London. Michael and James, welcome to you both. US President Barack Obama will touch down in Riyadh tomorrow for a Persian Gulf summit before heading onwards to Germany and the UK. The visit to Saudi Arabia could not have come at a more sensitive time. King Salman and neighbouring leaders are less than pleased, I think it's fair to say, with Obama's recent concessions, as they see it, to regional rival Iran. And a debate unfolding back home in the US is analysing the alleged role of Saudi Arabia in the 9/11 attacks and questioning the nation's counter-terrorism capabilities. Before we hear from James and Michael, a little earlier we spoke to Sir William Patey, who was the UK's ambassador to Saudi Arabia between 2007 and 2010, who talked to us about the credibility of those claims.
Certainly, when I was in Saudi Arabia, I had a lot of conversations with Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who's now the Crown Prince, on cooperation over countering terrorism. And the Saudis were avid in trying to clamp down on financial transfers. And lots of commentators level accusations against Saudi for funding terrorism, but there's no evidence of it. And I know the Saudis themselves, who regard Al-Qaeda and Daesh as an existential threat to them, have a big interest in making sure that funding is cut off.
Sir William Patey there. Michael Goldfarb, there you are. Commentators claim that Saudi Arabia is involved in some way in funding groups like ISIS, and it's complete nonsense, isn't it?
Well, it's not funding ISIS. That's ridiculous. But it is also true that over decades, and I mean going back to at least 1979, Saudi Arabia has funded teaching of what we call today Salafist or Wahhabist teachings, which may well have helped indoctrinate groups of people. They did create the organization that became Al-Qaeda by funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the war against the Soviets.
Well, in the 1980s. They will say that the U.S. also funded that
group.
Yes,
it was a mutually beneficial moment 30 years ago where Saudi Arabia had jihadis in its midst. They had taken over the Grand Mosque in 1979. There was a massive siege. And descendants of these people, you know, we're fomenting a rebellion against the House of Saud. And suddenly the U.S. said, well, we need to find a guerrilla force to fight the Soviets. That was Cold War strategy. And the Saudis said, well, allow us to send the son of our main builder, Mr. bin Laden, over there, and we can arm them, we can find people. But then the whole thing morphed and got out of people's control. The Saudis also bear some blame for a kind of incoherent strategy of arming and giving money to various rebel groups against the Assad regime in Syria over the last 5 years. So there is a lot of blame to attach to the Saudi government's behavior. But this thing in Congress, to me, is just yet another example of what happens when a country like the United States becomes so badly governed, and its legislature is bought and paid for by people. You know, you say, well, yes, a number of the hijackers can trace their origins to Saudi Arabia, but to somehow say that this puts the Saudi government in a position to be sued for damages is utterly ridiculous, and I don't know what that's about, except also possibly to embarrass Obama when he's going to visit the King of Saudi Arabia.
And yet, James Rogers, there will be some who say, well, you know, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. As Michael's just said there, Saudi Arabia has promoted this form of Wahhabism, Salafism around the world, particularly around the region, which has certainly not helped the situation. And yet they have been an incredibly close ally of the United States over the last 30 years or so.
Well, they have, and I think this is why Saudis are concerned by the United States. Perhaps rapprochement is too strong a word, but certainly they're working with Iran to some extent over the Iran nuclear deal. But the Middle East is, if it was ever a simple place, it certainly isn't the simple place it might arguably have been in the times of the Cold War, and the United States needs to build alliances with different people, and the United States does not have the clear view of the region, which perhaps it once did, which was certainly to support Israel, which it still does, but also in terms of making military campaigns against Iraq. That was very clear what things they needed to do and who was on whose side then, and it no longer is, particularly in the example that you've given in Syria, where the United States has not only had changing relationships with Iran, but also has had to do so with Russia at a time when it was keen to condemn Russia over its actions in Ukraine.
And there is this issue, Michael, isn't there, that, you know, for the Saudis, they see it as a bit of a zero-sum game. You're either supporting us or you're supporting Iran. And however much, you know, Barack Obama may say, look, the Iran deal was about a very specific issue, about not ensuring a nuclear weapon doesn't fall into their hands, you should be happy about this, they're going to not necessarily go along with his assessment of that, are they?
No, they won't. You know, and they're gathering, very interestingly, excuse me, some new quiet friendships. For example, one reads reports, and, you know, it's not anything that's going to be officially announced, but that there are quiet contacts between Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia now, based on this fear of Iran's growing influence in the region. But there's this whole range of things that are nipping at the heels of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There's a war on its southern border. They're engaging in war with Yemen, again against an Iranian-backed proxy group, the Houthis. And the potential for spreading instability in the region exists there, and Obama will want to talk about that. Then there's also, you know, last week the King of Saudi Arabia was in Egypt. Now, Egypt has to be coming in for some questioning in the U.S. because the Sisi government is turning out to be much more dictatorial and tyrannical than the government of Hosni Mubarak, which the Obama administration in the end was happy to see deposed by popular will and with comparatively little violence. So that's complicated. And then there's the price of oil. And the price of oil is a very interesting one because, you know, when the oil price collapsed a year ago, people weren't sure, why is Saudi Arabia continuing to pump oil? There's a glut, there's oversupply, and it's reflected in the price. Well, it was affecting Russia's ability to get a fair price for its petroleum exports, and that's important. And perhaps there was some contact between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. saying, oh, well, this is a good thing. But it's gone too far now, because what's happened is it's made fracking, shale extraction is not worth doing now because
the U.S. thought it would not have to rely on Saudi Arabia.
I mean, there are states in the U.S. that 2 years ago were boom towns, and now they're in a depression. Mm. I mean, that's the nature of the oil business. So there's all of this complication, and a little FaceTime, I suppose, is actually very important. But it's a very, very packed agenda if someone's trying to get, you know, a clear steer about what's going to be happening, besides which, you know, President Obama will be gone in 9 months' time from office.
Indeed. Yeah. And here's the other problem, James, is that these things are all very complicated. They've all got to be quite nuanced. There are certain things where you have to be, or, you know, it suggests you have to be pragmatic. And there's a bit of realpolitik. Now, that's okay for you to do if you're King Salman and you don't have an electorate. Mm. But if you're Barack Obama and actually, you know, you have Democratic supporters who will be expecting you to talk about human rights and democratic reform and women's rights in Saudi Arabia, while at the same time you're trying to keep Saudi happy on in various different ways, because actually that's quite important for the region. Mm. It's a tricky balance, isn't it, for him?
It is. It's extremely difficult. I mean, I don't think any high-level diplomatic visits by Western leader to Saudi Arabia is ever straightforward. But the commercial ties, I mean, particularly one thinks of the arms shipments there, which are worth so many billions of dollars to Western companies. It is a very fine line to tread because Western leaders have got workers whose jobs are reliant on some of those contracts, and at the same time they have constituents who are complaining about the issues which you've raised, specifically women's rights and human rights. And one looks at the number of executions which have taken place in Saudi Arabia this year, and this is obviously something which is a difficult issue for a Western leader to raise.
Michael Goldfarb, I just want to read you a bit from Barack Obama's speech in 2002 at an anti-war rally in Chicago. This is where he referred to the war in Iraq as a potential war in Iraq as a dumb war. This is before he was even a senator. But there's this line. He says, "You want to fight President Bush? Let's fight to make sure our so-called allies in the Middle East, the Saudis and the Egyptians, stop oppressing their own people and suppressing dissent and tolerating corruption and inequality." I assume we can imagine that while he probably still believes that, and he sort of suggests he still believes that in the recent interviews he gave in The Atlantic, he won't be saying any of those words at all when he's there.
Not a dicky bird. I'm certain of that. Excuse me. And to be fair, if the protocol people in Riyadh have an ounce of nous acquired during their expensive American educations, it has to be said, and their time in the Saudi embassy in Washington, there will be an opportunity for Obama to meet with the more liberal factions who don't necessarily live in Riyadh, they live in Jeddah, you know, and meet with people and talk about, you know, the improving, possibly, situation of women who can drive now and who can vote, apparently. That will be important, but I do think that the most important thing is for the necessary FaceTime to steer these next few months and to also discuss, you know, what to do in Syria, because the wellspring of all the terrible instability, not just in the region, but spilling over into Europe now at a time when the global economy doesn't need Europe to be preoccupied with what to do with a million refugees coming out of Syria. That's got to be the critical issue, I would think.
James, on that issue of Syria, I mean, in some ways, the US and the Saudis are allies in that they are at least both opposed to President Assad. And on paper, they're both saying they're opposed to ISIS. But it's a tricky partnership, isn't it? There are many other aspects. The Saudis are, you know, may well say, well, there should be democracy in Syria, but I don't want to say that too loudly, because then people say, why don't you, if it's good enough for Syria, why isn't it good enough for Saudi?
Well, that's one of the big challenges of international diplomacy, is situations like that. I mean, I think that Michael is right to raise the issue of Syria, simply because whatever the extent of the risk of Islamist militancy across the West is, this is inconceivable that is ever going to subside, let alone disappear, as long as the situation in Syria remains as it is. And it's the same for the entire region. Syria is going to, ISIS was forged and created in instability in war in Iraq and Syria. And as long as that instability continues in those two countries, then one imagines ISIS will continue to prosper too, if that's the right word.
One final thing on this, Michael Goldfarb. Do you think that, you know, if we've been having this conversation 4 or 5 years ago, the US and Barack Obama may well have been hoping that King Salman was not king, that there would be some sort of steps towards democratic reform. But given what's happened over the past few years, certainly the way the US will see it, do you think in some ways they'll be more comfortable dealing with a king who, at least in their eyes, says a few of the right things and does a couple of the right things rather than whatever might come next?
I think that, and I know the Saudis the ones who've been educated in the U.S. and work in the embassy know this. What the monarchy offers more than anything is stability. You know who the leader is. You know who the leaders are going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And in an incredibly unstable part of the world, that is a big selling point.
Yeah, but Hosni Mubarak brought stability.
I know. But the problem was that because he was nominally not a monarch. You know, if he had inherited the throne from his father, it would be a different situation.
All the monarchies in the Arab world are still fine. You're
absolutely right to point that out, because if you look at those Arab states that, you know, went through incredible instability trying to transition into a democratic system, ended up, you know, military coups, but they are not monarchies. And in fact, Mubarak was criticized because he was trying to create a monarchy yeah. for his oldest son Jamal to inherit. I think, you know, that the Saudis know that this is a real important calling card. And beyond that, as on my one reporting trip there, it's going back a decade, the American American consul in Riyadh who handled press relations said, what people don't understand is they are actually the liberals. And there are places in this country, and in fact, where their writ doesn't run. In the middle of the country, where the true Wahhabis live, they are sitting on a powder keg. And the US, would, in the long run, would much rather deal with the same people year in, year out.
Okay. Let's stay in the same region, but we'll turn now to Israel and sort of Israel, the Golan Heights, long occupied by Israel, but also once part of Syria. On Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a typically boisterous speech while visiting the Golan Heights, vowing it will forever remain under Israeli sovereignty. That hasn't sat well with the US State Department, who've responded saying that the Obama administration does not consider the Golan Heights to be part of Israel. But James Rogers, no one necessarily wants to help out President Assad in Syria right now, and Benjamin Netanyahu may see, you know, this unfolding crisis, which is showing no sign of ending anytime soon, as an opportunity to stamp his claim on the Golan Heights.
Well, indeed, and given the situation in Syria, no one is seriously going to suggest that would be up for negotiation anytime soon either. I mean, they have been under Israel's control since 1967, and like the other territories which were occupied during that war, there's no prospect of their changing hands. What's special about the Golan Heights is, of course, its tremendous strategic importance. And whoever controls them controls a huge swathe of territory, looking, depending on which way you look, either into Israel or into Syria. I've been there as a correspondent, and even though it's quite a long time since there was any large-scale fighting there, there are still abandoned military vehicles, there are still rusting artillery pieces you come across occasionally, and you can see quite clearly that it is a very fiercely contested, fought over territory, and if it hasn't been fought over on a large scale for some time, that doesn't mean to say that it's not going to be again in the future. So I think Mr. Netanyahu is perfectly safe to make these remarks now. One would not expect him in particular to say anything different. And indeed, the State Department has to restate the United States position. But of course, as I say, nobody at the moment is seriously going to raise this as an issue on which Israel should give ground, particularly now.
It's essentially grandstanding on all sides, isn't it, Michael Goldfarb?
Yeah, yes, it is. And I mean, I'm surprised that Netanyahu didn't mention how many wounded fighters have come out of Syria over the Golan and have been taken up by the Israeli military and taken to Israeli military hospitals. Whenever it happens, the Israeli press certainly is keen to let the world know that, you know, they are trying to provide some succor and safety for those who are trying to overthrow the Assad regime. No, it's odd that this should come up at this time. I mean, I think I think you're right. It's just a safe thing, a bluster for Netanyahu to bluster, which he needs to do I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's saying something he doesn't actually believe. Yeah. But on the other hand, he does actually need to bluster like this on a fairly regular basis, because as odd as this will seem to people listening, within his coalition government, he's probably more in the center than a lot of the people he's had to invite into the government
well,
in order to be able
thought.
To, you know, to put one together. You know, it's there's just as an overview, whenever you hear these things, you know, I think that, you know, we're all kind of dealing with a fiction at the moment, that there is at some moment going to be a return to negotiations that get us back to, a two-state solution based on Resolution 242. I mean, it's never going to happen.
Although,
we should start framing the discussion
maybe
that
not
way.
On that, but what's interesting, James, is that, you know, it was only, 2009, there were talks about the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria, which Turkey was very involved in. And this was sort of one of the reasons why Turkey and Israel fell out.
Yeah,
with
very
both
different
Erdogan
times,
and Netanyahu, I mean, where, you know, there were real discussions about handing back the Golan Heights.
There were, I mean,
we're talking less than a decade ago.
Exactly, yeah. very recent, but very different times. I mean, I have somewhere in my collection of books at home a guidebook to part of the region that I bought in the 1990s, which expressed the hope after the signing of the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan that a peace treaty between Israel and Syria was surely only around the corner. But that's looking back a couple of decades to a much more optimistic time. But indeed, one only has to look back a few years to a more optimistic time. And yet one considers John Kerry's attempts to restart the Israeli-Palestinian peace process of a couple of years ago now. And you can, I think most people who'd ever spent any time observing that conflict closely gave that very little chance of success. And indeed, sadly, of course, that's the way that it turned out.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests Michael Goldfarb and James Rogers. Up next, we'll be discussing Chinese state secrets and guessing Xi Jinping's birthday.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Michael Goldfarb and James Rogers. News has emerged today of a Chinese citizen who may be executed for leaking state secrets. Government worker Huang Yu reportedly leaked 150,000 sensitive documents. And the death sentence is a stark reminder of power in China. But the nation's definition of state secrets can range from industrial information to even the birth dates of state leaders. And one has to ask whether the long historical tradition of maintaining secrecy in China against foes such as the West is always beneficial to the nation and its people. James Rogers, we're living in an age of leaks, WikiLeaks, Panama Papers. Even football transfers have their own leaks as well. But China leaks, if we can call it that, would be something of an altogether different nature, wouldn't it? Because this is, you know, we're talking about one of the most closed governments, certainly, in the world.
Yes, and we're also living, obviously, given the examples you've just given, in an age of massive leaks as well. And the man in question is supposed to have leaked 150,000 documents. I mean, obviously, the days of officials approaching reporters in bars or cafes with a couple of brown envelopes are long gone. So, of course, for those societies, for those governments, for those political elites which prize secrecy as they do in China, then the challenges are all the greater. And if indeed this story is confirmed and this man has indeed been sentenced to death, I think it shows the seriousness with which they take it. And of course, stories like this are made public, of course, part of pour encourager les autres, as they say.
And Michael Goldfarb, you know, I think it's a bit glib to try and compare what happens in the US to a police state. But there is a problem, isn't there, for countries like the US to criticise China if they have decided to execute this person, because China can turn around and say, well, look what you've done to Chelsea Manning.
Yeah, exactly. and they could easily point to Britain and say, why is Julian Assange living in the Ecuadorian
Let's not get into Julian Assange, who's wanted on charges of sexual assault in Sweden, and that's why he's in Ecuadorian embassy.
In this day and age, the ability for the humblest clerk with access to information, if he's motivated for whatever reason to leak it, is astonishing. It isn't just a guy walking out, you know, with a folder and meeting someone, you know, his contact, you know, like in a John le Carré novel, and handing over the brown paper envelope. It really isn't. And it says a lot about, I mean, if it says anything about China, because we don't know what's in the documents, what it says is the misdemeanor level almost of these leaks, and being the response of the state being a death sentence. What it says is that China really is even more ferociously concerned about protecting all knowledge of it, except what the state itself decides can be rationed out.
And James Rogers, is that actually possible for states like China, like Russia to a certain extent, which is obviously far more open than China, but still is, when it comes to government, a pretty closed book? Is it possible for them to hold on to all those secrets these days, or do you think it has become so much tougher?
I think it's extremely difficult. It certainly has become tougher, but one has to look at it from the other side too, because if we talk about reporters getting brown envelopes in bars once, and the secret police used to have to go to bars and look out for people there too, with the old newspaper with two eye holes poked in it so they could watch what people were up to. Now they simply join the dissidents group on Facebook and find out what they're doing that way. So in a way, it's also, while it has presented tremendous security challenges to states, particularly those seeking to preserve their secrets, all the high-profile examples we've just been talking about, it does also, of course, make the job of the secret police or intelligence services easier in some ways too.
The one other thing I just wanted to mention here is that there was an incredibly good piece in New Yorker last week about secrets coming out of Syria, that documents that proved the complicity, indeed the direct involvement of President Assad and his inner circle in actual war crimes that were being smuggled out in enormously creative ways.
Dangerous. But I mean, in the old kind of the old fashioned analog way, you know, secreted in trucks on very dangerous journeys,
or stuck to people's bodies. Stuff has even been hidden in caves for the day when Syria is actually safe. Do you think that, I mean, obviously it's too early to say what's going to happen with those documents. No charges have been even been investigated yet. But again, there is this chance that...
You mean the Syria documents?
Yeah, in Syria, that secret states, you know, may want to make sure that they don't lose their secrets for reasons of being held to justice as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's one really encouraging example for those of us journalists who sometimes wondered, why did I bother doing that story? I keep reporting this story and it never changes. I mean, I think that's true of journalists in war zones very often. But I think the conviction recently of Radovan Karadzic is a real example, 20 years after the fact, why it was so worth it that all those correspondents kept hammering away at it in Yugoslavia in the 1990s.
I wanted to mention something about the Pulitzers. We don't have time. Never mind. Michael Goldfarb, James Rogers, thank you both very much for joining us today on Midori House. The programme was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. A bit of music next. Then at 1900, it's Section D with Josh Fennett. More news on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.